Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's here time for us to talk about what's going on in the news this week. And fresh from putting up their coronation bunting and baking the coronation quiche, it's our National Director, John Stevens. Good morning, John.
Hi, Phil.
And our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds. Hello,
well,
Adrian.
Well, hello. I've got so much to say about the quiche.
Well, there we are. We were recipes available online, I think.
Will we come back to the quiche at some point?
I do hope so, Adrian. I'd like to know if you've tried it. Is there a gluten-free version?
Well, you can't. Let's have a recipe corner later.
Brilliant.
In this coronation special.
We are going to focus on the coronation today, given that it's such a big sort of national event, an important and significant moment for the nation. Before we do that, let's just talk about the opportunity spiritually the coronation brings. So there is a service of worship as part of this. FIEC churches, I know, are doing things this weekend, seeking to reach their communities. I'm volunteering at a community activity as part of the weekend, just to try and mix with
what
some
activity?
Of my neighbours. There's a massive coronation event on the green in a local village to us, and I'm volunteering as part of that event.
Market Harbour has four street parties.
Okay.
Two of which are in your road.
Are you responsible for John?
The bunting has been going up this week, actually.
So well, one is in Charles Street, which crosses your road, and the other is in your road itself. So, John, I expect you to be there leading the way.
Fantastic. I mean, churches are doing things this weekend as well, John, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, a national event like this always provides an opportunity for the gospel at multiple levels. As you say, it involves an opportunity to connect with the community and maybe meet with people that you might not otherwise be able to meet with or connect with. Obviously, the service itself has a strong Christian element. The Archbishop of Canterbury is going to be preaching a short sermon as part of it. There'll be readings from scripture. Much of the symbolism of the coronation is all about the rule of Christ and the king being the representative of Christ. So there's loads of things from which we can actually perhaps have evangelistic conversations with people off the back of the coronation that as they've watched it, perhaps many will be kind of watching it, wondering what's going on, wondering what it means. That might open up opportunities of conversation. So I think it gives us a platform, perhaps, certainly at the beginning of the week, maybe with people over the weekend, to be able to talk about that. There'll be some people in the country who are very strong kind of monarchists. It's obviously a very important thing for the Anglican Church. And I would imagine Anglican churches are making the most of this opportunity. But in our own church, we're not an Anglican church, but we're grateful for good government. We recognize this as an important moment. Mm. So we've got a guest service. I'm going to be preaching from Colossians chapter 1 about Jesus as the true king that we need. Mm. And that's just using an opportunity. I'm going to pick up on loads and loads of things that are said and done in the coronation and just simply show how Jesus is the one who's the king who will ultimately be able to save us and rescue us. So I think it does provide opportunities both for personal evangelism, community connection, to basically comment on the coronation and what's said at it. And as with everything in life, we want to be able to wisely make the most of every opportunity that God brings to us. That doesn't mean we have to turn every single conversation to something evangelistically. I think that's often a problem. I think we do need to be more responsive. But as people might have questions or there might be natural opportunities, we need to be bold to speak into those and grasp that moment.
It was interesting, wasn't it, seeing on our own church WhatsApp group, one of the ladies at church has got all her bunting up, but in the middle there's some text about who the King of Kings is, just to pick up on what you said.
It's a great example, actually, because she lives in a little village where people walk past her front window, and she's put some things up in the window about Jesus being the King. And people sort of stop and read. So there are very simple things that you can do. There were some tracks, a bit late to order them now if you haven't got them, but there have been some tracks.
I mean, 10 of those said literally hundreds of thousands of tracks went out.
I think, you know, these things which loom large in the national consciousness are an opportunity to speak to people, not least because I think people are asking about, you know, who this question and a moment when people are asking, who am I? Mm. Not in that kind of difficult way for Christians, you know, when you're having discussions about sexuality in general, those sorts of identity questions, but just more broadly, who am I? Am I a citizen of this country? If so, what's my connection to it all? And people will come up with different conclusions to that. But that's a great moment to speak into as people are thinking about what is my identity. We've got something to say about people of the King. And I think for that reason, it is a great opportunity.
I think lots of the coronation is symbolism. And one of the problems in our culture is that people don't grasp and understand the symbolism. Symbolism doesn't speak for itself. It needs to be explained. The word needs to kind of explain the significance of the symbols. And I think it'd be really interesting to see whether that is done as the coronation is broadcast and commentators explain. I was watching BBC News last night and they were talking about kind of St. Edward's crown and looking at it and kind of talking about how it was made by Charles II and the jewels that were put on it and its size and its height. And then they happen to mention on the top of it, there's a cross. But that was almost completely then ignored as to why that has any significance whatsoever. But the whole point of that is actually symbolizing that Christ is the one who rules and is over the king. In the same way that the orb is meant to be a kind of a pattern of the world with a cross on it, and it's symbolizing that Christ is the one who kind of rules the world. So there's loads of opportunity in that symbolism. It is conveying something of Christian truth. And there is that opportunity to at least point to it and explain something of it.
Does the coronation spoon fit into that at all? This is the oldest artifact. Is that got any Christian symbolism? I'm asking, I don't know the answer.
It's what the oil is poured from.
Yeah.
It does have a symbolism.
Yeah.
Whether it's Christian or not
is a different matter.
It's a moot question.
I mean, the anointing of the king is the bit that I'm least comfortable with in the whole
service. You've blogged about this, haven't you, this week? Just explain to us why that is, John.
Because basically it's replicating the position of Old Testament kings, the anointed king, the idea of kind of David and of Saul. So it's basically a borrowing of Old Testament ritual. And this is a kind of a sort of inevitably what nations and religions do. They want to go back to the kind of the Old Testament kind of pattern. It seems to me that's not the way the New Testament thinks of sort of civil rulers. It seems to be giving the impression that kind of Charles is a sort of a messianic kind of figure. You know, people recently say, you know, will Charles be a new King Josiah who will bring about the Reformation? And that sort of understanding of what earthly kingship is, it seems to me, is a thoroughly Old Testament idea. I'm not really sure I know what the anointing is meant to symbolise or what it's meant to do.
I think it's more than just an Old Testament king, Giles. So I'm with you most of the way there. But it's interesting that some of the other symbolism, the robes that the king is going to wear, which, by the way, is going to look very weird. I don't think we've probably seen in our lifetime, the three of us, anything like this. Not a funeral, not a royal wedding where most people are just in normal dress. Not even a state opening of parliament, which has been downplayed really in the last few years. I just think this will be on, you just think, what is going on? But the strange things underneath the coronation gown that the king is going to wear are described in all the kind of bumf and commentary as being his priestly robes. So I think that thing about, you know, there's almost a sense in which the king is seen as a messianic figure is right. And I think that's my big problem really with the service. It seems to ignore the fact that Jesus has come, is the king. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not, I don't believe in state religion. And so I've got lots of issues with it. But I do think it provides an opportunity. I just wonder, though, John, how many people will be thinking at that level of detail. I think a lot of ordinary people like me, I put myself in that category, will just be looking at it and going, what?
Yeah.
And, oh, wow. Or, ooh, nice. But I'm not sure whether people will be looking at it thinking, oh, I wonder what that's for. I wonder what that's for. So maybe we have got a role to do to kind of exegete it a little bit.
But I think that's actually all personal evangelism. Actually, evangelism is not done by those great public events. It's actually the individual conversations that follow on from them. And yes, for the vast majority of people, it will pass them by. I suspect they'll watch it and they'll think, what on earth is going on here? And they will watch it as a historical pageant. That's effectively what it will be viewed
as. Are we stuck in the past then? So that's quite an interesting question for me because... you know, it's in theory, it's a modernized coronation. And I'm not quite sure what that means. So I don't remember the last one. I think it means the peers are not going to wear their crowns. But actually, when you read through the actual service and when you see what's going to happen, it doesn't look very modern. It looks very old fashioned.
Antiquated.
So do we basically kind of hunger for the past, do you think? Is that what's going on in this sort of pomp and ceremony?
I think there's a longing for identity that is bound up with history. So, I mean, the coronation and elements of the coronation go back all the way to certainly the early Saxon kings. There's a fascinating podcast on The Rest is History, talking about the origins of the coronation and that historical link that goes back even to the Bronze Age with those biblical connections. And so, in a sense, the coronation links the past with the future. And I think that's a challenging balance. Is we want to have that sense of historical continuity, but does that represent where we are now and how does that look to the future? And I think there have been some changes to the coronation. So there's this attempt to blend the kind of the continuity of history with the sort of the discontinuity of the present. And actually, whether or not that's been rightly judged, I think is going to be interesting. So you've got lots of the fundamental elements of the ritual retained. The peers are not paying homage and are not invited to the coronation the way that they were. That indicates the kind of, in a sense, that the different role of the aristocracy, the ending of the kind of hereditary House of Lords. There's the recognition of more of a plural culture with representatives of other faiths, kind of bringing the king in. There's been a slight introduction to the coronation oath, in which when the king promises to uphold the reformed faith. Before that, it's stated that in doing that, he is also seeking to uphold freedom of religion for everyone. So there have been significant changes, but whether the whole thing in the end connects with contemporary Britain and how it sees itself, I think that's a challenge of our whole national identity. There will be people who watch the coronation and think that's who we really are, and this is a recovery of something that's been lost in public life. There will be people who look at the coronation and think this just does not connect with who I think I am, who I think, what I think Britain is, and certainly not what we would want it to be in the future. And in fact, somebody commented today that they thought this coronation is a kind of a stepping stone to the one that will be next. I think what will be most interesting is how this is received and then what changes it leads into the next one. And I think that has a lesson for church, because churches often have a history. They have a connection with the past. I mean, after all, we go back to the Bronze Age in the Bible. And that sense of how do you maintain continuity but yet you be culturally relevant to the moment is the challenge that lots of churches face. How much do you change? How much do you keep? Are you genuinely connecting with people in the present? And I think the coronation is seeking to do that. Whether it does it well will be judged afterwards. But that's a challenge for all of us.
Do you think that this coronation has captured the imagination of the public? Do you think the monarchy is still popular now that the Queen has passed and King Charles is coming to the throne? Is this a changing of the guard in that respect? I asked that question because I heard a really interesting debate on the radio earlier in the week. Obviously, they were bringing on the polar opposites, those who were monarchists and those who were Republicans. But in the middle, somebody just said, and I thought it was really interesting, I think most people are just indifferent. Is that a fair comment?
Well, they're more positive than they were a year ago. So polling demonstrates that when the Queen died, or just before the Queen died, Charles's popularity really as a potential king was very low, 30% or something. And it's much higher now. And I think that's because in the last year, he's kept his head down. He hasn't been quite the nutter that people thought he might be. And I think he's done a good job as a constitutional monarch. And I think he's shown some, he's shown sobriety and calmness, and he's responded well to things. So I think people have warmed to him. It's very interesting to me, actually, that how the coronation will change that for me is significant. Because my gut feeling is it will just show that the monarchy is a slightly odd thing that no one really gets. And we kind of like it, but we don't know why. That's my sort of feeling for how we'll end up with it. I'm not sure whether it'll make a huge difference the popularity of Charles. I think it's almost impossible to change your constitutional system. And so I think most people end up being indifferent to it, not because they're for it or against it, but just because it's in that category of, it's not hurting anybody really.
It's not particularly relevant to your day-to-day life.
No, not really.
I think it'll be hard to tell until after the event, actually. A commentator was making a point, I think is quite right. The British character is a sort of cynicism about these kinds of things until they actually happen. And then we kind of embrace them.
And say, so don't we do them well?
There was a parallel with the kind of the Olympics. Everybody thought the Olympics in London was going to be dreadful. We wouldn't be able to do it. And actually,
it was a spectacular success, and that changed
the public. And I think the coronation is an opportunity for that. It puts the monarchy in the public eye in a way that it hasn't been. And it has the potential to change the way that people kind of think, depending on how it's done. So I think we honestly won't know until after the coronation.
I think it will raise some interesting questions, not least, exactly what is our relationship to other countries and what is the Commonwealth all about? So we know the Commonwealth was very big for the Queen. When she was crowned, of course, there was still an empire, essentially, or the remnants of one. I think that's not the case now. We've got the Falkland Islands, haven't we, and Ascension Island, isn't that about it? So I don't think you can really talk about empire. So we talk very strongly about Commonwealth. The anointing screen has all the countries of the Commonwealth on it. And yet, even this week, Jamaica are saying this is going to speed them towards
being a republic.
So I think that whole question of how do you represent Commonwealth, which is a slightly false, well, it's not slightly, it's a kind of false construct, really, isn't it? How do you represent that idea of Commonwealth without appearing patriarchal and all those sorts of things. I think that's one of the kind of big questions that's really unanswered about monarchy in general. And I think the Queen was loved as a head of the Commonwealth because she was a lovely old woman. I don't think people will have the same warmth towards Charles. So for me, that's one of the big questions that's up in the air. Not least, well, I think that question and also what our new national anthem should be.
We'll come back to that. John, you want to comment on that?
I mean, I think there are a couple of things that Charles are doing that are very winning and significant changes. So, I mean, he has spoken in terms of wanting to be a monarch who serves, so that the service begins with him saying, I've come not to be served, but to serve. Jonathan Dimbleby, who's a friend of his, was being interviewed, saying that he's going to have acute embarrassment about this idea of the kind of the public homage to him, saying that Charles has never wanted homage at all. He doesn't want to be a person who's revered. He doesn't want that kind of model of the monarchy. And so, in a sense, that is subtly changing in his role and his connection with the public. And I think in some ways that's likely to be a very winning way of speaking about the monarchy. And there is an irony that, some of the causes that Charles has championed over his lifetime are actually now publicly shared.
Yes, that's right.
You know, the environmentalism,
change,
kind of buildings, the kind of... So actually, he's been slightly ahead of public opinion on a whole variety of things, and things that made him appear ridiculous and were mocked 20 years ago
and now embraced
are actually now mainstream politics. And I think that will sort of endear him to the population. But I mean, as Adrian said, I think that an event like this, where there hasn't been a coronation in 70 years, I haven't seen a coronation in my
lifetime.
Living
memory, really.
You know, most of us have not experienced this before. It inevitably raises the question of how is the nation different? It brings home the vast change that there's been since 1953.
So let's explore that, John. So I've been chatting to my grandparents about the 1953 coronation, and my gran said that her mum and dad bought a television specifically to watch the coronation. People piled into their lounge to watch the coronation on this kind of 8-inch tube TV in black and white. And it was this kind of pivotal moment. The war was over. It was seen as this new kind of era being swept in 1953. It is a chance to look back. Will this coronation have the same, will it be the same kind of line in the sand as that appeared to be 70 years ago?
Well, there's no doubt that coming out of the Second World War, and rationing was still in place in 1953. So in 1953, butter and cheese, cooking oil, meat, bacon were all still rationed. People were still living
like now,
austerity.
meat and bacon. So bacon's not a meat.
But the vast majority of people, life was nowhere near as easy and nowhere near as sort of good as it is today. Life expectancy was only about 69 years compared to 81 now. Kind of wages and income were way lower. So average weekly salary then was about £180 a week in real terms today, which is more like £400 today. So, I mean, there's been massive kind of change in people's expectations. And I think in a period in which Britain was recovering from the war, was beginning to decline compared to kind of America in terms of world terms, the coronation was a kind of a moment that lifted people's sort of spirits. Whether it slightly gave them an impression of the importance of Britain that wasn't the reality, and that that over time that began to dim, I think it is a different question. So I don't know whether this coronation will kind of mark such a change. We're not at that moment. We've experienced so much change economically, socially, politically over that 70-year period.
Technically as well. Technology is completely different.
Yeah, I mean, there were something like 2.1 million televisions sold in the couple of months before the coronation. Statistics suggest about 17 people were gathered around every TV to watch. And you have to remember, there was only one channel. That was it, BBC. It wasn't until 1955 that you got ITV. And now we've all got Netflix streaming. That the availability of kind of communication and material is just astonishing.
And it was shown in cinemas as well, I think, wasn't it?
For that reason.
Yeah, there was a pathé. Yeah, yeah. Well, there was a pathé. I asked my mum about it, and they bought a television for the coronation. My mum was 10. And they had a magnifier in front of the television set so lots of people could watch it. And I said, what do you remember about the service? She said, absolutely nothing. And she said, I do remember going to the cinema a few weeks later and watching a Pathé film, kind of Jane and Jim. It was seen through the eyes of two children who had attended the coronation. She said, I remember that. I said, what do you remember about the service? So I was interested to think, you know, how they modernized
it.
And she said, absolutely nothing at all. And I think this is part of the problem with reflecting on the past is that the further the past gets away, we have a general sense of what it was like, but we tend to overlook hardship because hardship is hard. You want to forget about it. And we tend to elevate things that were good. And I think we do that in church life as well. I think that's what nostalgia is. I think essentially in nostalgia, you look back on the past, remembering the good things in an elevated sense and slightly ignore the things that were harder. And I think that's always the problem in church life, that we want to be thankful for the past, want to be grateful for it. But when you live in the past, you tend to ignore the things that were difficult and that actually weren't as good. and you elevate the things that were good. And I think you see a lot of that in Christian nostalgia and church nostalgia. I think that's what we do. We sort of think that there was a golden age of Christianity when it was easy to be a Christian and when it was easy to do evangelism and it was easy to, you know, follow Christ in the workplace, whatever it was. And actually, there weren't any hardships. I don't think that's never been true, has it?
No.
It's been true.
I think there's a really interesting thing here on the psychology of Christians at the moment. I think because so much has changed over that period, Christians have felt so much loss in the way of culture and how it's changed. That they have fallen into looking back to that past as something to be recaptured. And I think there is a deep kind of Christian nostalgia that thinks the 1950s were somehow an ideal or better, or that we ought to return to them, and that most of the social change that's happened since then has been kind of regressive. I think, in contrast, liberal progressives look to the future with some sort of optimism. They think that there's going to be a better world coming, that they're going to be able to change things. And I think Christians, at one level, have slightly lost our confidence because of that experience. Whereas actually, the Bible tells us we need to be fundamentally forward-looking people, that God's kingdom is coming and will come, and that is our hope. And I think a nostalgia that thinks that the past was better, that fails to really understand what the past was like, that fails to take into account all of those aspects in which life was worse, we idealize it. So, for example, I mean, I think there's no doubt that in 1953, the position of women in society was far worse than it is today. Mm-hmm. They were not protected in the workplace. They didn't have equal pay. In some professions, you couldn't be married. Many women found themselves trapped in abusive marriages and were unable to leave because of the laws that were there. There's no doubt that in 1953, the population was generally racist in a quite overt way. The ethnic minority was only a kind of a very, very small percentage of the population compared to 14% today. And those first immigrants who came on the Windrush and came to the UK, even though they had been citizens of the empire, were quite frankly treated appallingly and subject to overt kind of racism.
In the church, as well as outside the church.
So to think this is some sort of golden period, many people were living in significant poverty. They were in kind of slum housing with outside toilets. And that was the life for a very large number of people in the 1950s. And even though there was higher church going, that doesn't mean to say that there was kind of greater Christianity. In actual fact, the reality is that true Christianity, evangelical belief, had been declining from the 1850s. And by the 1950s, the majority of religion of the churches, both Anglican and nonconformist, had been taken over by liberalism. It was kind of a social Christianity, a cultural Christianity. Evangelicals were deeply despised in that period. It was only the beginnings of the recovery of some kind of sort of reformed evangelicalism led by people like sort of Lloyd-Jones and Stott and Packer. So the idea that that was some golden age for the church isn't true at all kind of either. Evangelicals were under immense pressure, primarily from a church that had abandoned the gospel. Today, we're more under pressure from the culture. But we shouldn't think that this was some golden period of kind of church growing and Christian influence. It simply wasn't.
Can we talk about the service?
Yeah, you've got the liturgy there, haven't you?
Well, I've got the liturgy here. I printed it out and had a read through it. I've got a fundamental problem with liturgy. So I understand it, what it is, and the coronation. What it isn't is a service of worship.
So when I said at the beginning, there's a service of worship.
I don't think,
you don't think it is.
Well,
okay.
Not as I understand it in the New Testament. And that's because I have a high view of the local church. Mm. So actually things that happen outside of that, it's difficult to find a category to put those in. But it has Christian elements in it. I think Johnny's right about that. I don't think it's a Christian service, though. I think there are things about it which actually are unhelpful for the gospel. And I think...
For example?
Well, for example, the king and queen are going to receive communion privately on their own. Mm. And well, I don't think that's my theology or the New Testament's theology of what the Lord's Supper is. Mm. It becomes a very sacramental, almost magical thing that they get. And so I understand why it's kind of happening in sort of Church of England, state religion kind of circles. But I think actually we need to be clear that as we help our people watch this service well, to say actually this isn't a normal thing. Some of it's in Latin. So, you know, most of it is sung to you. There's one hymn towards the end that people can join in with if they want. Actually, my doctrine of a service of worship is that it's extraordinarily participative. Mm. It is the people of God gathering together to sing the praises of God, to pray to him, to listen to his voice, ultimately to meet Christ together. And actually, this is not that. Mm. So I think this is one of the problems. It's why I don't believe in the establishment of the church. It's one of the problems when you try and make state occasions Christian, that actually you're wrestling with just what is going on. You know, you could even ask, what is an abbey? in the sort of terminology. So I think, I want people in the church to have a good view of it and understand some of the symbolism, perhaps as John was talking. But I don't want them to think, well, this is great. This is a Christian service of worship. I think we need to have more confidence in what we will do together on Sunday, the following day, as churches, and say, this is really where the action is. The action is not in Westminster Abbey in a slightly odd celebration. Actually, the action is as the local church gathers, as people encounter Christ together. So I'm praying really that people don't lose confidence in the ordinariness, which is not ordinary at all. It's supernatural, of a normal church gathered on a Sunday.
Was there anything you particularly wanted to pick out? You've got to open at a particular page.
Well, where do I start? No, I'm fine. I don't want to deconstruct the liturgy. I'm not a great fan of liturgy, anyway. And I just think that why use one word when you could use three?
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it does seem to be, it could be half an hour short.
So the liturgy needs editing, says Adrian Reynolds.
Well, I mean, it's a national occasion and there's lots of pomp and ceremony and, to me, quite a flowery language. You know, and now the choir sings an anthem in Latin, and now we listen to this, and now this happens, and that slightly does my head in. But what I worry about is that people will watch it and say, "Oh, isn't that wonderful?" Whereas actually, who gets to the end of Sunday? Our service is at 3 o'clock on a Sunday. Who gets to the end of Sunday at 4:30, having sung some good songs together, having prayed, having listened to God's word, and say, "Wow, that was wonderful." But that's exactly what we should be doing.
Yeah.
I think in some ways that just is a reflection of...
I'm a cynic.
It's a reflection of the whole debate of the Reformation, really, as it unfolded. Because actually what you described there as happening in the coronation is happening in lots of Anglican churches and cathedrals every week. Mm. That would be
and
similar
Catholic
to the way that they operate.
Yeah, yeah.
And in some sense, the Elizabethan settlement that was reached was a compromise in the Anglican Church between reformed theological doctrine and actually the practices of the Catholic Church prior to that that were largely retained, certainly in their outward forms. And that led to all sorts of debates about whether or not that went sufficiently far in kind of reforming things to make it the kind of worship that reflects the teaching of the Bible. And those of us who are nonconformists are on the side
that's
of those
us.
Who, yeah, that's indeed, are on the side of those who think that it didn't go far enough. And actually, I look at the coronation, and that reminds me precisely why I'm with the Puritans, I'm with the nonconformists, I'm with the dissenters, because I don't think that looks very like the kind of way that the New Testament describes the nature of Christianity. But that's an ongoing thing that's been true from the Reformation onwards. And it's not surprising, given what the Anglican Church is in its kind of Elizabethan kind of form, that is the nature of the way that it would be conducted. So I think it raises for all of us the question of how far should our church practice in the end be deeply shaped by the Bible? And how far can we bring in kind of past rituals?
So, John, would you sing the national anthem in a church service?
I'm perfectly happy to sing the national anthem at an event or whatever. Yeah. I think that's a sort of an issue of national identity. I don't have any problem with that. I probably wouldn't sing it in church, but that's actually because I don't want to tie the gospel to patriotism and a particular nationality. And I think there are people who could find it difficult to sing that. I don't think that's a kind of a Christian worship song for that context. So I would feel uncomfortable doing that, basically because to me, for all of those reasons, I'd rather sing something else that kind of doesn't have...
Phil, there are some alternatives.
Problems. Yeah, so there's been a poll about replacing it.
Is so it's a bit too jingoistic, apparently, and especially if you read all the verses, it's a bit too jingoistic. So bizarrely, people were asked, if you think it's not appropriate, what would you replace it with? And top of the list was Rule Britannia, which is even more jingoistic. Jerusalem, which is, well, there you go. No, I'm not going to tell you what I think about Jerusalem and William Blake. And I Vow to Thee, My Country, all of which seem to be unsuitable. So I was glad to see that coming in with 19% was Sweet Caroline. And 6% Wonderwall by Oasis.
I mean, that's a great song, mid-90s.
Yeah, I would sing that in church.
Fantastic. And we've just got a couple of minutes left, brothers. And we did say we'd talk about the coronation quiche.
Recipe corner.
So this has been put in the papers and stuff. People can bake the coronation quiche. Will you be baking it in your household?
Well, the coronation quiche is interesting to me.
Because coronation chicken, right, was from 1953. Yes, is that true?
Coronation that is true. Is that true? And yeah. it was a recipe that was put together for the coronation by one of the well-known chefs of the time. Is it Jamie Oliver at the time? So it was a woman, but well-known chef at the time. And it's interesting that the chief rabbi is going to be eating coronation chicken at St. James's Palace the night before the coronation. And there has been an article in the paper this week saying that more people will be eating coronation chicken than the coronation quiche because it's very difficult to make.
Quiche is difficult to make anyway.
Well, it's not quiche. According to the chief executive of the Alsace-Lorraine Quiche Society, who has written and complained.
We'll put the website in the show notes.
It's not a quiche, and it instead should be called a pie or a tart. So a coronation tart. Yes. Which, so it is interesting because the whole point about the coronation chicken was it was quite a frugal thing. You just poached some chicken, which was the cheapest meat. You poached some chicken, you mixed it with readily available ingredients, and it gave a flavour of this commonwealth that we were part of. You know, it was a bit exotic, really. And it was very easy to make. Coronation quiche tart is very difficult to make. It doesn't really have that same sort of symbolism, but except it's been chosen especially by the king and the queen. So I think it's a good indication of how actually trying to hold on to something from the past doesn't quite work today. So there is something in that, I think. I will not be eating broad bean quiche. I mean, come on.
John?
I'm not a fan of quiche, basically because I don't particularly like egg in that form. But
have
equally,
we got Christians around the table that don't eat quiche? Is that even allowed?
The other thing about quiche is I have a prejudice against it because it sits with a certain kind of Christianity, which it appears rather too often.
I think as nonconformists, we need to embrace coronation fish and chips or something.
Having
like that.
Said that, I do like broad beans. I'm absolutely
not... You have to shell them twice. No, I mean, what is that all about?
I'm absolutely not with Jacob Rees-Mogg, who said he won't be eating because he hates broad beans and they're always vile.
I did like what you said online, which is that he should get his nanny should make him eat.
I wasn't going to refer to that, but yes, I did that. Actually, my absolute favourite kind of coronation story was about the town of Cinderford, where they basically got
which is where?
I don't know where it is, actually. I'd heard about the town. I think it's in Devon, but I might be wrong.
The town of
Cinderford, and they have a competition in which you are invited to bring your chickens, and they will be judged, and one of them will be crowned the coronation chicken.
At the brilliant. End of that.
You can't do that
with a quiche, although, well, yes, we won't.
Very good. Brothers, it's been great to talk about the coronation. I do hope if you're listening, I do hope you enjoy your bank holiday weekend.
Phil, God save the king. Yes. Really?
We would love God to save the king, wouldn't we? Absolutely. Do enjoy your bank holiday weekend. This has been In the News, the FYEC podcast. Do rate, leave a review, and so others can find it, and we'll speak to you
again. And we'll play Wonderwall as the outro music, will we?
I don't think we've got the rights to that. Good to chat to you, brothers. Have a good weekend.